Welcome to the Counter Vortex with your ranter, Bill Weinberg, ranting at you in the wee hours of April 26th, 2024, as always from my apartment on Manhattan's Lower East Side, which fortunately is not under aerial bombardment. Here in New York City, we are awaiting eviction yet a second time of the protest encampment up at Columbia University, an effort to establish one at New York University here in my hood was nipped in the bud as riot police moved in to clear it on Monday, April 22nd. That night happened to have been Passover. There was a Seder for ceasefire held by Jewish student activists at the encampment at Columbia that evening. In spite of the relentless drumbeat from the Jewish establishment and right-wing politicians that the protests are filled with anti-Semites and that Jewish students don't feel safe on campus. Most recently and prominently, such accusations came from U.S. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, who made an appearance at the Columbia campus on Wednesday, April 24th, and called for the National Guard to be sent in. And he appeared to be calling for the federal government to order in the National Guard over the heads of New York State authorities, which is ominous. And in fact, it must be acknowledged that there have been instances of ugliness at the protests that have been eagerly seized upon and exploited by the Jewish establishment and right-wing politicians, which makes the matter a little messier. Although I must add that I saw none such at the NYU protest, which I attended on Monday. And from what I can glean of the few such instances at Columbia and the videos that have been avidly shared online by internet partisans, they appear to have actually taken place off campus, seemingly on Broadway or Amsterdam Avenue, outside the campus gates and by outside agitators, so to speak, not by actual students. I am particularly referring here to the one which you might have seen where some Yahoo shouts that October 7th should happen 10,000 times. That definitely was not on campus. And meanwhile, there has been so little outrage in the media, and of course, complete silence from the Jewish establishment and right-wing politicians, about the incident on January 19th, in which protesters at Columbia were attacked with some kind of chemical agent by presumed Zionist counter-protesters and had to be hospitalized, or to the so-called doxing truck that has gone around the campuses, including Columbia, electronically displaying the IDs and images of Palestine Solidarity activists and calling for them to be blacklisted by prospective employers or graduate schools. Before we move on to the main point of this rant, a little context for what we are going to be discussing, which it is vitally important to keep in mind. The United Nations is demanding a clear, transparent, and credible investigation after mass graves containing the bodies of hundreds of men and women were discovered this week on the grounds of two hospitals in Gaza that had been under assault and occupation by the Israeli military. A total of 283 bodies have been uncovered so far from Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis after Israeli forces withdrew on April 7th. The United Nations Human Rights Council says more bodies were found at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, which has been reduced to an empty shell after a two-week Israeli siege ended there on April 1st. So a total of over 300 bodies, with some reportedly found stripped naked and with their hands tied. Gaza's civil defense authorities say they uncovered many of the bodies from what appear to be temporary graves. The Israeli Defense Forces deny burying the bodies, but say that they exhumed the mass grave at Nasser Hospital to search for possible dead hostages. The bodies were presumably then reburied, although it is not clear by whom. UN Human Rights Chief Volker Turk has warned of commission of war crimes, which seems a rather inescapable conclusion. And this is what I've been thinking about over the past days. In our discussion last week on the 81st anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, we noted that Mordechai Anilevich, the leader of the uprising, was killed on May 8, 1943, when the Nazis used poison gas to flush out the tunnels and bunkers that the resistance fighters had dug under the ghetto. I confess that I thought of this when I happened to come across the following story this week from Israel's Progressive and Independent, 972 magazine, January 31st, entitled, "A Hostage's Mother Says Toxic Gas from Israeli Bombs Killed Her Son. Is She Right?" I will read some excerpts. In mid-December, the Israeli army discovered the bodies of three of the hostages kidnapped from southern Israel to the Gaza Strip on October 7th. The soldiers, Ron Sherman and Nick Beazer, and the civilian, Elia Toledano. Their families were initially informed that the three men had been killed in Hamas captivity, meaning by their captors, but Mayan Sherman, the mother of Ron Sherman, soon declared otherwise. "Ron was indeed murdered," she wrote on her Facebook page on January 16th, "but not by Hamas. Instead," she asserted, "her son was killed by bombings with poisonous gases," quote unquote. Mayan made her claim after reading the inconclusive findings of a pathology report presented to her by a delegation from the Israeli Army's Casualties Department and the 551st Brigade, whose soldiers recovered Sherman's body from Gaza. "The delegation told us they don't rule out gas poisoning as a result of the IDF bombings, but they're not certain," quote unquote, she told 972 magazine. According to two Israeli security sources who spoke to 972, on condition of anonymity, this wouldn't be the first time that Israeli airstrikes targeting Hamas's network of underground tunnels in Gaza have killed people in this way. The army, they say, is well aware that bombs exploding in tunnels can disperse toxic gases, such as carbon monoxide. In May 2021, for example, amid its broader assault, named Operation Guardian of the Walls, the Israeli army launched a specific attack on Hamas tunnel networks, which it called Operation Lightning Strike. Gadi Eisenkot, who was the IDF chief of staff when the operation was planned and is now a member of Israel's war cabinet, said later that the operation was intended to turn the tunnels into a death trap, quote-unquote, and kill hundreds of Hamas members. During those attacks, which ultimately killed only a few dozen Hamas members, those hiding in tunnels were killed not only from a bomb that hit them, but also from the fact that the bombings release gases inside the tunnels, quote-unquote, a source told 972. The source explained that the army did not use a chemical or biological warhead, but rather discovered that certain bombs penetrating the tunnels could, as a byproduct, spread toxic gas over a long distance in a closed compound. A second source confirmed this, adding that tests have been conducted in the military on the subject, which have shown that inhaling these gases in confined spaces is lethal. 972 could not confirm whether suffocation by toxic gas was a deliberate tactic used by the Israeli army in the current war to kill Hamas members hiding in tunnels. In response to these allegations, the IDF spokesperson told 972 that the army, quote, uses legal means of warfare only in accordance with international law. The IDF did not in the past and does not currently use byproducts of bombings to harm its targets, end quote. Once again, account from Israel's 972 magazine, January 31st. After reading this, I felt a little more vindicated in the admittedly somewhat dangerous parallel I had drawn in my rant last week between the Warsaw Ghetto resistance fighters and Hamas. A parallel with a big emphasis on the mutatis mutandis, that is, acknowledging the obvious differences, about which we'll have more to say. This Warsaw Ghetto analogy to Gaza first emerged from Masha Gessen in an essay in The New Yorker, December 9th, entitled In the Shadow of the Holocaust. Gessen notes that there are key differences between the two. The Nazi claim that the ghettos were necessary to protect non-Jews from disease had no basis in reality, while Israel's position that the isolation of Gaza is necessary to protect against Palestinian terror attacks stems from actual and repeated acts of violence. Yet both claims propose that an occupying authority can choose to isolate, immiserate, and now mortally endanger an entire population of people in the name of protecting its own, quote, unquote. But in my online probings, it also came to my attention that Israelis and their supporters have been making the opposite analogy between Hamas and the Nazis at the Warsaw Ghetto. Apparently, there is a video clip that was first being circulated online by Hamas supporters in an ugly and gloating way of a small Israeli boy, looks to be about 6 or 7, who was apparently among the hostages taken on October 7th, being taunted by his captors and raising his hands above his head in a kind of feeble effort at self-defense. And the clip is now being circulated by Israeli online partisans who are comparing it to the famous Warsaw Ghetto Boy photo actually taken by German troops to document their clearing of the last bunkers in the ghetto where civilians had been hiding. You've probably seen the photo. A Jewish boy of about 6 or 7, with his family, their hands in the air, as German soldiers menace them with submachine guns. If you want to read about this, you can Google up this story. Picture this. Holocaust history repeats itself. A haunting image of a little boy in 1943 Poland bears heartbreaking resemblance to a widely circulated video of a child being taunted in Arabic, Los Angeles Magazine, October 12th, 2023. And this is very revealing. The way both sides Nazi bait each other. You see over and over posters and memes and graffiti equating Israel and Nazi Germany, or intertwining to imply equating the swastika and the Star of David. And you hear over and over from the Israeli side about how more Jews were killed on October 7th than on any day since World War II. Which is, of course, factually correct, but the way this is being endlessly repeated to justify or relativize the far greater mass murder of Palestinians in the 6 months since then is what's so appalling. And ironically, one of the most egregious examples of genocidal rhetoric from the Israeli side came last week from Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, one of the so-called hardliners in the current government, who said in an interview to an Israeli army radio station that there are, quote, 2 million Nazis in Gaza who want to slaughter, rape, and murder every Jew, end quote. So, implicitly justifying mass murder on the basis that all the Gazans, all 2 million of them, are Nazis. Exactly the kind of rhetoric that Putin employs against the Ukrainians. And in both cases, an example of what we call fascistic pseudo-anti-fascism, a perverse and ultra-cynical but quite widespread phenomenon. I really wish that each side would examine the Nazi parallels to their own side instead of using Nazi parallels as a propaganda weapon against the other side. I am going to note another case that is causing me great anguish. This one from my side, as it were. That is to say, the left and the anti-Zionist side. Earlier this month, Hobart and William Smith Colleges in Geneva, New York, relieved of her teaching responsibilities, political science professor Jody Dean, explicitly in response to an article she wrote for the Verso blog, April 9th, entitled, Palestine Speaks for Everyone. There is an online petition for her reinstatement at change.org. But let's take a look at what she actually wrote. Quote, the images from October 7th of paragliders evading Israeli air defenses were, for many of us, exhilarating. Here were moments of freedom that defeated Zionist expectations of submission to occupation and siege. In them, we witnessed seemingly impossible acts of bravery and defiance in the face of the certain knowledge of the devastation that would follow. Who could not feel energized seeing oppressed people bulldozing the fences and closing them, taking to the skies in escape and flying freely through the air? The shattering of the collective sense of the possible made it seem as if anyone could be free, as if imperialism, occupation, and oppression can and will be overthrown, unquote. Etc. It goes on in that vein. And you keep hoping as you read that she's leading up to a but she isn't. There is no mention of what these guys on paragliders actually did after flying through the air. That is massacring civilians. in violation of every law of war. She goes on to make a similar point regarding the Palestinians to that which I made last week in regard to the standard depictions of the Holocaust emphasizing Jewish suffering rather than Jewish resistance. She writes, quote, "The images of Palestinians that we see in our imperialist settings are usually pictures of depictions of devastation, bereavement, and death." I'll point out that pictures of depictions is a little bit redundant. Continuing, "The humanity of the Palestinians is made conditional on their suffering, on what they have lost, what they endure. Palestinians get sympathy, but not emancipation. Emancipation would eat away at sympathy. This image of the victim produces the good Palestinian as a civilian, even better a child, woman, or elder. Those who fight back, especially as part of organized groups, are bad, the monstrous enemy that must be eliminated. But everyone's a target." End quote. Yeah, I get the point, but again, there's no mention of what is meant by fighting back. And I'm sorry, there's a big difference between throwing stones at occupation troops, which became the defining symbol of the First Intifada, and massacre of civilians, which is what we saw on October 7th last year. Now, sure, if you want to sign the petition, go right ahead. I am not supporting Jody Dean being suspended from Hobart College. But I am calling for having an honest conversation about this. I mean, if you support mass murder of civilians, please come out and say it openly. And I give goddamn Smotrich creds for being more blatant, at least, rather than wrapping up his call for mass murder in this feel-good rhetoric about flying through the air in freedom. And I know that I will be accused of both-sidesing here, as it is called, but again, there has to be clarity about what this means. I recognize that there is one side that is the occupier and oppressor, and the other is the occupied and oppressed, and that the violence of the occupied and oppressed is not to be judged the same way as the violence of the occupiers and oppressors. But mind you, I am not saying not to be judged. I'm saying not to be judged the same way. I'm choosing my words carefully here. The root violence is that of the ongoing siege of Gaza, now escalating to actual genocide. The even longer illegal occupation and colonization of the West Bank, now escalating to undisguised annexationism. And the system of internal apartheid within the borders of Israel, with that some 20% of the population, which is Palestinian, relegated to second-class citizenship and systematically discriminated against. And no condemnation of the Hamas attacks that fails to recognize, and indeed to emphasize that, is legitimate. But that doesn't mean that Hamas gets a blank check for attacks on civilians. And in the sense that I'm calling for both sides to engage in a little self-criticism and self-examination, rather than merely weaponizing the Nazi parallels as propaganda against the other side, yeah, I do have something to say to both sides here. Sorry if that's terribly unfashionable, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. There are two essays that I found very useful in weighing the whole question of political violence. One is Their Morals and Ours, Leon Trotsky, 1938, in which he famously wrote, quote, "A slave owner who, through cunning and violence, shackles a slave in chains, and a slave, who through cunning or violence, breaks the chains. Let not the contemptible eunuchs tell us that they are equals before a court of morality. Exclamation point, end quote. That is an unarguable perception, but there are countervailing principles, including that articulated in the Quran, Surah 2, verse 190. Fight in the cause of Allah those who fight you, but do not transgress limits, for Allah loves not transgressors. But the second essay I want to briefly quote from here in defense of the countervailing principle to that articulated by Trotsky is Neither Victims Nor Executioners, Albert Camus, 1946, in which he grappled with the post-war reality after his experiences with the French resistance during the war, and he noted that paradoxically, all sides in the configuration then holding the world in a balance of nuclear terror claimed to have the interests of freedom and advancement of humanity at heart, and dismissed the pacifists as utopians. And he replies ironically, quote, To refuse to sanction murder is no more utopian than the realistic ideologies of our day, with realistic in quotation marks. And the whole point is whether these latter are more or less costly. End quote. So yeah, the principle articulated by Trotsky gets a say on this question, but so does that articulated by Camus. Both these perspectives need to be weighed. And the difficult reality remains that either Arabs and Jews are going to have to find some way to share the land of Palestine, or it is going to be Armageddon. Ask yourself honestly if you see any third option. This has been Bill Weinberg with the Counter Vortex. You can check us out online at countervortex.org, where everything that I rant about on the podcast is fastidiously blogged up, hyperlinked, and documented. Please support us on Patreon, patreon.com/countervortex. We need just a dollar or two a week from you to keep going. Join the Counter Vortex. Join the resistance, and rant on you next time.